Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Dr. John DeSalvo as we talk about the Shroud of Turin and other realms and realities. So check in with us in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. John, do you do any work toward 2012? Do you look at that strange date?
Yeah, to be honest with you, I don't think anything is going to happen. I always say, you know, I got fooled with Y2K. I got stuck with 20 gallons of water and food. And, you know. I think, if anything, it's a spiritual meaning, that a beginning of a new spiritual era. But I'm not really concerned of anything physical or major disasters or phenomena. That's just my opinion. I don't think there's really a lot of explanations for the ending of the Mayan calendar at that date. There could be many different reasons. And the only thing that makes sense is so many different cultures talk about that time, you know? So I may be missing something. There may be something there. And I'm always open, but there's nothing really that hits me over the head, even the astronomical alignments or whatever. Those happened before, I think. So I don't know. I mean, who knows? We'll know pretty soon.
Well, there's no doubt about that. Okay, to the phones we go. Let's pick it up by going to San Francisco. First of all, Bob's with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Bob, go ahead.
Hey, George, I got to apologize for a historic mess up I did. You know, I drunk dialed you a few times and wasted your time and the audience's time. I don't know. I'd like to amend or redeem that in one way or another, but we could talk about it another time, perhaps.
Not to worry, Bob. Go ahead.
Oh, if you knew who I was, you would maybe disagree. Listen, you're great. Fantastic. It's an honor to speak with you both. And I listened to your guest. I'm sure he's way more well-read than I am. But referring to the areas he was considering for future investigation or so forth, you know, I read a book called Acalon, historic novel, but it takes into consideration the glyph stuff of the Mayans, and I read Aztec. I read 1491, challenging the Clovis theories and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Reads more like a textbook. I believe it was written by a frustrated dad whose son was learning history of the, it goes from the tip of South America all the way up. Fascinating book. I learned quite a few things, like how it was the Native Americans that taught us democracy or influenced our forefathers. And then Alan Eckhart, wonderful books. I'm reading The Dark and Bloody River right now, recommended by my father-in-law. But I had read Frontiersman, and that, boy, I love that. And, of course, actually, The Covenant by Michener. But anyway, that first one, Acalon, fascinating. And I just wanted to get your response off the air, whatever is appropriate.
Well, you know, I really appreciate those suggestions. If you could do me a favor, if you could email me with the name of the book and the other suggestions, I would love to look into those, because that would be real helpful. So I get the spelling right, I'm looking at the right book.
What's your email address, John, or how do they get to you?
You know, the easiest way is just if they go to GizaPyramid.com and just email the director. It's just drjohn@GizaPyramid.com. So if you just go to GizaPyramid.com and email me, I will get the email, and I would really, really appreciate those suggestions. I'm always looking for new sources and good references. So I appreciate you taking the time to call and telling me about that.
All right, great. Thank you, Bob. Did you ever read the book Three Magic Words by Anderson years ago?
No.
Yeah, that was a fascinating one. And one called The Magic of Believing, which I've talked about a lot on the program. Little tiny red book by Claude Bristol, which will change you too. You're into all that. You know, the one thing I haven't asked you about is extraterrestrial life. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I believe it exists. I'm a believer in UFOs. Again, I don't know where they're from, or they're from another planet, a multidimensional, whatever. I guess, too, the reason is I've been following ufology since I was in junior high school, and I've known a lot of people. I've never actually seen a UFO, but I've known a lot of people that have. And again, one of my closest friends is Becky and Betty Andreasen, you know, the famous Andreasen affair. Betty was abducted in 68 and one of the most famous and most studied abductees of all times. And we've been working together on different things, Becky, her daughter, and myself. And I've had the experience that these things are real and what they are talking about are real. They're not made up or imaginative. And therefore, whether they're extraterrestrial, from a different dimension, from a different time, I don't know. But, that's an area I'm really working on also. So, it's an area I've never eliminated. I know Stan Friedman well, and I know Jess Marcel Jr., and I did some research with Roswell and discovered certain things about the symbols at Roswell and some of the magical symbols I was working on. So I just think it's a wonderful area. And obviously, like you and your listeners, I'm very fascinated with programs on ufology and abductees. And as I mentioned on the last show, alien implants and what they mean and could we test them. So an incredible area to research. So, anything at all that has that's a mystery and has a way you can look at it scientifically, I'm very interested in.
All right. Next up, let's go to James out there in Indiana. Hey, James, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
My question is about spirit communication.
Mm-hmm.
Using electronic devices such as a Frank's box or a radio hack shack, could that hold the same consequences as like a Ouija board?
Oh, my God, that is a wonderful question. In fact, several of my friends are experimenting with the ghost box, and I have an EMF device. And I'm not sure I can give you an answer, but certain friends that I talk about that I know that are ghost hunters and are very psychic say, yes, you have to be careful. When they do their ghost hunting, they use protection. Some have claimed they have brought ghosts back with them to their house. I would say if there's that possibility, and to be careful, because I don't know if your listeners are familiar with this. I think it's called the Frank's Ghost Box. It's a frequency device that varies the frequency, and supposedly you can actually have real-time communications with ghosts. And in fact, Betty Andreasen's husband, Bob, has the ghost box and experiments with it. But I heard stories both ways. Some people think they're safe using digital voice recordings too, EVPs, and never got anything negative. But, you know, that's a really wonderful question. I wish I had a definitive answer. And I guess the best thing I could say is that, you know, you have to be careful. I heard stories from that it could be dangerous.
Well, you do have to be careful when you get involved in things like that.
Well, what an excellent question. I'm amazed.
These listeners are the best.
They really are. I mean,
let's go to Holland, Michigan, tulip country. Robert's with us on Coast to Coast. Hey, Robert, go ahead.
Hey, George. This is my first time, but I wanted to let John know I've Ouija'd a lot when I was a kid until I Ouija'd it with a girl and I got this. It says, I want him, and she asked who it was, and it says, I can work through him, and my name is Satan. So, yeah, you can get into all kinds of trouble with them things. Plus, I've also been able to read the crystal ball, tarot cards, and the rest of it. So, yeah, you got to be careful because it becomes a trade-in between your soul and what's going on with reality.
Yeah, good suggestion. I think any time you experience dabble with the occult, you have to be careful. And that's why I always say, too, many times it's not for even research and experimentation and science. It may not be for everyone because there are risks and you have to know what you're getting into. I think, too, you know, people that do work in these areas, they do use protection to a certain extent. But again, you know, your comment is very important. We're in uncharted territory and we have to be careful. To me, the best protection that I really use, I think, is my basic faith in God. Now, one thing I want to mention, following up with your question, many years ago when I was dabbling in different occult areas and I really felt there were certain negative things that were coming at me and bothering me. And I wasn't a Christian at that time. And I learned 100 different names of God and protection things. And none of them seemed to work. And then the one time I said, Jesus, the evil and the energy disappeared, never came back. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. Maybe there's something to it. But there is power in the name of Jesus, whether you're a Christian or not. And I would say for me, for protection is the belief in God, the power of God, and in the name of Jesus. So something to consider, you know, whether you're a Christian or not, but there is that that power and energy. And it's, again, you have to know what you're doing and be careful. But I always, again, the protection of God is the most important.
Have you ever come across a psychic vampire, John?
No, I hope I never do.
No, you don't.
But, oh, you know what? Hey,
you can feel it, though.
George?
Yeah.
Oh, one thing I wanted to bring up you may find interesting that's related to some of this. You've heard of course, the famous Saint Padre Pio, the Stigmata.
Yes.
He was a saint.
He bled where Jesus was
crucified. Right. He had, like, the wounds of Christ, the wounds in the palm. And they weren't in the wrist. The stigmata is different. And the wound in the side. And supposedly, he also had the ability for bilocation. He would be in two places at one time. So was he able to move through realms? But it's very interesting. I got an email from my cousin today, Paul DeSalvo, who's been like a brother to me all my life, and sent me an article that he got from a priest from Italy, and it was in Italian, and trying to translate it before this show. But it seems like Padre Pio, many years ago, I think the last year he died, a person went to visit him and had a handkerchief in his hand. And before he left, Padre Pio put it up to his face, like in a mystical way, not to implant perspiration, and gave it to him. And years later, it developed into an image. It looks very similar, like, to the shroud image from the photos I saw.
Really?
Yeah, and I were trying to translate the Italian, but a scientist had studied it. And I think he basically said the image is a result of a kind of a lack of pigmentation. I think he's trying to describe the dehydration process like on the shroud, but unless I can get a better translation or more information, he said like it lost its color. So I think, and he's talking about the fibrils are not colored their entire length. I think he means, again, the problem is the translation. If anybody has any information about this, let me know. And I thought this was very interesting, the timing that I got it today from my cousin. I gave him a call and we talked about it before the show. And he didn't know this, but I am very devoted to Padre Pio. In fact, I have a reliquary of Padre Pio, a first-class relic with a piece of his hair, which I actually wear. So I thought that was very interesting that I had no idea of this information. And it could be nothing, you know, it could be a legend, but it came out of Italy and it came from a priest. And I'm going to try to look into that because wouldn't it be fascinating if here's another example of, again, he bilocated. He moved supposedly into different realms. So maybe this is an effect of him being able to do that. Isn't that fascinating?
Well, if you end up doing some work on that, let me know because.
I just found out today and it just kind of frustrates you because, oh, my God, I want to get as much information as possible. But I thought the coincidence was really, really interesting. And again,
now, you know, John, there are no coincidences.
Yeah, I know that's true.
It all and happens.
Perfect timing to be on your program talking about this on the morning of a Good Friday, you know?
Absolutely. Let's go to Fernley, Nevada. James is with us on Coast to Coast. You're with Dr. DeSalvo. Hi, James.
Hey, Georgie. Hey, John. How's it going?
Good. Hi, James. How you doing?
My question was the man in the Shroud of Turin, he seems to be about 6 foot tall. Is that a little tall for that region and the era of man?
Oh, very good question. Yeah, it is actually kind of tall. The estimates of his height are anywhere from maybe, you know, 5'11" to around 6'1" or 2". You know, it would depend on his position and how he was draped. So that's why, you know, we don't get an exact figure. But yeah, that around that size would be a little bit taller for a person at that time in that area. As far as I know, again, I'm not an expert on that, but that's what people tell me. So very, very good observation. Yes.
Unless there were giants. Of course, he wasn't a giant.
I don't think so.
No, he was not a giant. Okay, we go now to Harold in Crosby, Texas. Get you in before the break. Go ahead, Harold.
Hey, Doug, how you doing?
Good.
Good. Hi, Harold. How are you tonight?
All right. Look here. I wanted to make a point about the Charter of Tehran.
Sure.
Sure.
Okay, well, the Christian belief that Christ rose from the grave is true. And it was a fact that the tomb was empty. But in the Urantia book, it points to that the chief of archangels went before Gabriel, and the angels asked for the mortal body of Jesus. And what happened was, when Christ rose, he rose in a semi-spirit form. The material body did not rise. What happened was, the angels and the celestial host removed the stone, took the body out, and sent it through immediate dissolution. In other words, his body, his mortal body, did decay like all natural bodies decay, but it was just instantaneously. And that might explain to the scientists why the cloth is like it is.
You know, that's really interesting, because actually I thought about something like that many years ago, that you're saying like the physical body disintegrated in like maybe a split second. Is that correct?
Yeah, instantly.
Well, you know, what was interesting about that, when I started to get interested in this at that time, I contacted Larry Arnold, who was the one of the world's experts on spontaneous human combustion. And I thought, is that a possibility, a mechanism? But it turns out it really wouldn't be, because it wouldn't produce any type of images that we see. But the point being is that what you just said may not be that different than what I proposed about the matter going into another dimension, whether it did that or disintegrated immediately, and then the spiritual body moved into another dimension. Very good. Excellent idea. Really appreciate you sharing that.
Good observations, John.
Excellent observation, yes.
John, the Dead Sea Scrolls book that you wrote some time ago, any new information about the Dead Sea Scrolls?
You know, not that I'm aware of. I have to admit, I really haven't kept up on it, so there could be information out there that I'm not aware of. The only thing personally is they had the Dead Sea Scroll exhibit here this year at the Science Museum, and for that it was touring the country, so I hope people had a chance to see that. It was just really amazing. But no, I really haven't heard anything. I wish something new develops. I wish more scrolls are found, or as I talked about last time, there may be a missing copper scroll that would give us information where supposedly treasure is buried, according to one of the copper scrolls of the Dead Sea Scroll. So,
all right. Well, stay with us, John. We're going to come back. We're going to take final phone calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Absolutely. Hey, for just pennies a day, you can become a Coast Insider Streamlink member, podcasting downloads, and have some fun. I've got a meeting tomorrow, by the way, early, where we're going to talk about the Android app, and I'm going to get an update on that, as well as our internet television program like YouTube for you, and a couple other things. So we'll get the information. I'll pass it on to you sometime next week. I'm taking off tomorrow night. It's my daughter's birthday weekend, and George Knapp, kind enough to fill in for me this Friday, and he will be on this Sunday. That's his regular night, which happens to be Easter Sunday, but you know the pledge, live program for you on a holiday. So George will be doing that for you on Easter. And as we get into Memorial Day, in about a month or so, I'll be live on that Monday night for you on Coast to Coast AM. Let's come back in just a moment. We'll take final phone calls with Dr. John DeSalvo on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, well, we've got more calls than time, so let's get right to it. We'll go to Hollywood, California. Eddie's there on Coast to Coast. Eddie, you're up. Hi.
Hey, George.
Hey.
Hey, John. You are a talk about Padre Pio.
Oh, mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Can you repeat that?
Padre Pio. He asked you.
About. Oh, yeah.
Are you a follower of Padre Pio?
Yes.
Well, I went to confession. When I was a child, I went to confession. I confessed with Padre Pio 1-on-1.
Oh, you're kidding! Oh, I'd love to hear what happened. Not your sins, but what happened.
I want to know the sins.
I had no sins. I was 10 years old, honey. I had no sins. I was pure. okay? But so I walked in, you know, here's a place called Pietralcina, which is with where the convent was. It was a small church, you know, and in the back of the church he had this room. And, you know, the priests, they would let some people in, you know, and so I was in line, and so I was lying to go confession with Padre Pio, you know, and so they get me in the room, and there's this big room, and there's this big confessional, wood, and there's Padre Pio, and I'm walking towards him, and he's sitting there, he's looking at me, and he has his hood on his head, you know, because he was a monk, you know, he had the hood on his head. And it kind of scared me, so I went up to him and I kneeled down on the pad there. And Padre Pio said something, something with his hands, and I noticed his hands, you know, because he had the wounds, you know, and he had these gloves around the hands, these special gloves. But there was a smell that was just nauseating, the smell of this medicine on his hands. It was called, I think it was like moxicautry or something like that. But it was so strong, it just knocked me out. I couldn't say anything to him. And he got impatient. And he said, you better start telling me something. So tell me something. And I couldn't say anything. I got so scared.
Was there a long line to confess to him, Eddie, from other people?
Oh, I mean, all the way back to Naples, Italy. I mean, just...
Wow. Whoa.
The people would flock to Pietralcina and Padre Pio, and he was a strange guy because he could be very angry, and he could be very loving, you know, but at the same time. But he was, you know, what he was. I mean, he had this special power. And when you sit in front of him, like I did as a child, I will never forget it until I die. This man that, you know, but the thing that really shocked me was the smell. The smell of the medicine of the wounds, and so when I couldn't say anything, and he said something nasty to me, that was really just like he just said to me, like, get out.
You know what's interesting about the smell? There's something that he had that was called the odor of sanctity. People would smell like violets or flowers from his wound, or when he would appear to them, they would have that smell. And that is very interesting. You really shared an interesting story.
Good story. Now, of course, these weren't violets that Eddie was smelling.
No. The other thing, you know, Eddie, that I've heard from people that went to confession, which is very interesting. One person went to confession, and they didn't even tell Padre Pio their sins. He started telling them, and they would have to just say, yes, Father, yes, Father. He could read the minds, or somebody would go to confession, and when they got done, he said, well, you forgot this sin, and would mention it. That was very, very common. With people going to confession for him, and just an amazing. But you know, I guess that was a good story because it shows there's a human aspect to the saints. You know, they're
they get upset. They have short fuses.
You know, and but everyone. You know, like I said, people sometimes criticize the veneration of saints, but again, they're like pointers towards God. They help us. They set examples for us, and they many times inspire us. But I think with what I find so interesting again with Padre Pio is that there's just a number of miracles and a documentation that occurred around him that it's just something supernatural was happening, and so that again that's why I found this napkin image going to be very fascinating to see if there's something there. So that was a great story. I never you hear so many different stories of people that met Padre Pio. That was just fascinating.
Let's go to Port St. Lucie, Florida. Nice area. Joshua, take it away. Hi, Josh.
Well, hey, George.
Hi.
I actually, after the last time you got on and talked about Enochian magic, I did some research on it. I mean, I started looking up through the internet. I went through, was it the Golden Dawn websites? I went through. I found out on YouTube, on various other places, there are places with many different versions of the Enochian calls.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually found one that turned out, I think, that was the Enochian Call of Spirit. And I dedicated, I don't know, 3-4 nights to trying to pronounce it the way he was pronouncing it. And eventually, you know, one night I actually got it through where I was able to say it through with a relatively, you know, decent pronunciation, I guess. And I went to bed and got this just this really great feeling. All of a sudden, after I finished, I was just went to bed. And I had this experience that night where this has happened to me maybe only twice in my life, including this time, where I had this experience. I woke up in the middle of the night, but I wasn't fully awake. And I got this sense like there was a presence. I couldn't see it, but there was like something over me, over my the bed, looking down at me, almost like it was laying parallel to me in the air. And without being able to control my, I was like sleep paralyzed, but it didn't bother me. I wasn't scared by it. And I was speaking. My mouth was physically moving, speaking in a language. I had absolutely no idea what I was speaking. And after a minute or so, it just stopped and went away. And, you know, I sat there, vegetated for a few minutes and blinked. But it was this incredible experience. And you know, I don't know how to categorize it.
Well, it might have been a little bit of sleep paralysis there, too, John. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you mentioned sleep paralysis because I used to experience that as a kid all the time and never knew what it was.
Oh, it's horrible, isn't it?
And I would wake up and then I would see like visions above my bed, and I guess that would be considered remote viewing. But, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, you know, nobody knew, you kept your mouth shut because you don't want people to think you were crazy. But, you know, it's funny. But to respond to the caller's comment, I'm not sure what call he was using. And the other question is, I don't know, it's usually good when you do something like this, like I always say, to end it with a banishing ritual or, you know, a prayer to make sure you closed off anything because you don't want to keep things open. So, you know, again, I would have no idea what he was experiencing. But like I said, I always say to people, you know, be careful, follow the directions, and always, you know, use your discretion. So it's... isn't that interesting about sleep paralysis, George? You know.
Oh yeah. Did you ever see The Old Hag when you were a kid? Do you know about that?
The what?
The Old Hag syndrome.
No.
You don't know about that. All right. There are two different things. Sleep paralysis, I believe, is a medical condition. It happens. Where you're just frozen in bed. It's petrifying to a lot of people. But there's another thing called the Old Hag syndrome, where people actually see this ugly little old lady sit on your chest and try to take your breath away.
Oh, and you're kidding.
Primarily, they're kids that see this. They generally grow up to be sickly. It's a bizarre syndrome. Bizarre.
Oh, my God. That must be so frightening for a kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's actually physical symptoms, you said.
Yeah. They are convinced... So who would I be to doubt them that this old hag comes and gets them?
Wow, that's again, I've never heard of that. But
I'm glad that didn't happen to you.
No, thank God. You know, my sleep paralysis would usually see visions during it. Once I saw like angels come into my room. I felt I saw sometimes remote scenes in the town. And again, you know, as a kid, you chalked it up to your imagination, but you know, maybe it was. I mean, who's to say? But then reading about it later, it was like, gee, maybe that was some part. You know, the other interesting thing, you know, we talked about saints. I just to throw this in, but when I was a kid, my family was very devoted to Saint Anthony. Listen, what Italian family in New York wasn't devoted to Saint Anthony? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And there was an old statue in an old church. My mother used to take me to pray to. And once when I think I was about 11 years old, I was in there and the statue like opened his eyes and looked at me, and I I thought it was an optical illusion and looked away, and then it continued to stare, and I forgot about it all these years, but I never forgot about that experience. So I believe it was real and it was some kind of message. I don't know what it meant, but you know, the idea that, you know, paranormal events happen to average people. We don't always know what they mean. I think one problem we have is something may happen to us. The veil may open a little. We may experience something, and right away we want to define it and put it in a box and explain it. Well, maybe we can't. Maybe we will eventually. I mean, you know, an experience maybe that happened to you 40 years ago, only now you'll start to understand it. And so I think one of my advice to people that do experience, a religious supernatural events or something that is positive, and but they don't know exactly what it is. Don't worry about it. If there's a purpose for it, I believe God will reveal that in his time. And just, you know, thank God for the experience and see what happens. Because I think a lot of people, especially kids, experience these things. It's a normal thing. But, you know, they're afraid to say it, or people laugh at them or tell them it's their imagination. And if we maybe cultivated that in our children, and we would have more psychic kids and maybe a better society. Who knows?
Have you ever heard of the St. Joseph statue situation, where you get the statue of St. Joseph if you're trying to sell your house, and you bury him out in front of the house, and your house sells after you say a prayer or two?
No, I never heard that.
Yeah, yep. It's you can Google that. St. Joseph, comma, house sale, and you'll see what pops up. It's an amazing thing.
That's interesting. I was also, I did research many years ago, I guess it's kind of all related, regarding the apparitions of Mary, you know, from, you know, Fatima to Lourdes to Medjugorje, even the non-approved ones. And I thought there may be some physical phenomena involved, because when you look at a common denominator, the way a lot of the visionaries described it, there was almost like a sonic boom many times when Mary appeared. And there seemed to be several sources of vibration, like light energy, high and some low. And so I started to think that maybe Mary's apparitions were doors opening from other realms. That was the first indication in my research that I realized that we may be looking at openings to higher realms, the spiritual dimensions, with a lot of this supernatural occurrences that happen in the religious settings. And it was very, very interesting that I never pursued it further than that, but I thought this would be a very interesting area to follow up with further research, the actual science and physics of what occurs during an apparition. The problem is you can't have them at will. You know, you got to look back at them and interview the people and find out a lot of the older ones, people aren't alive anymore.
Well, that's a good point. Let's go to Michael, Hampton Roads, Virginia. You're up with us. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Hi there. Dr. DeSalvo, I wanted to give you this reference. I'm writing a book on the Shroud of Turin, but I want you to focus on Matthew 24, verse 30, because in my book, I unfold why, in verse 30, the sign that shall appear as the Son of Man can only be the Shroud of Turin. No other competing object in history fits this identity. Secondly, in that verse, it says, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn. I explain in my book why it is that all the tribes of the earth mourn after the appearing of the Shroud of Turin to the whole world as the sign of the Son of Man in 1978. Why do they begin to mourn later? It actually comes as a result of this show and your conversation with George Norrie, because you revealed that the Roman Catholic Church, by preventing further scientific testing of the Shroud of Turin, are preventing all mankind from knowing beyond the shadow of a doubt that this was the burial cloth of Jesus Christ, and that it could only have been produced by extraterrestrial technology. The third point in that same verse of Matthew 24:30, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven, comes after this final indictment of the Catholic Church, including the statues of St. Joseph, the apparitions of Mary, and all those distractions from the key point of the scientific civilization that resurrected Jesus Christ and left the promised image in the hands of the organization that was responsible for his crucifixion. They shall look on him whom they pierced.
Very interesting. Michael, we got to run. We've only got about 45 seconds left to go. John DeSalvo, want to wrap things up?
Yeah, thank you very much, George. Listen, I first want to wish you and your Coast audience a blessed Easter, and God bless you and your family. And again, George, I am very indebted to you for having me on to share my research and my interests. And I want to thank you and all the Coast to Coast staff for being always so nice to me in hospital. And again, thank you for the opportunity. Again, God bless you and the Coast audience.
Well, we think the world of you, John. You have a wonderful Easter as well with your family. And so here's the big question. You're making a turkey or a ham?
I don't know. I don't make those decisions. I play right. It safe, you know?
It's primarily, it's always a ham at Easter. That's what mom
always
used to do.
I actually prefer ham.
You got it. All right, John, take care of yourself. John's books, by the way, all linked up at coasttocoastam.com under his website, GizaPyramid.com. Don't forget George Knapp sitting in for me tomorrow so I can have a little enjoyment with my daughter who's celebrating her birthday, who has told me not to tell anybody how old she is. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Jason King, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasour, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.